Many of us dream of breaking away from our day-to-day lives to do something completely different, to live a dream. Today, we hear from a young Iowa couple who are doing just that. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Grant and Denise Staskel sold their house in North Liberty, bought a boat, and plan to spend the next 6 months sailing the Pacific Ocean. Conversation with Denise and Grant in our second half hour today. Before that, this week, Hy-Vee's retired chairman and CEO Rick Juergens was honored by the Food Marketing Institute. The first half hour, we'll listen back to my 2012 conversation with Juergens, where he talks about the evolution of food shopping. That's all coming up this hour after a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Hy-Vee, shop Hy-Vee, where there's a helpful smile in every aisle.
If you don't recognize this jingle, I'm going to guess you just beamed down from another planet. Or perhaps you're just new to Iowa or to the Midwest. Hy-Vee was founded in 1930, and today it's Iowa's largest supermarket chain, an employee-owned corporation which has 235 stores in 8 states. This week, the Food Marketing Institute awarded its most prestigious honor, the Sidney R. Rabb Award for Excellence in Serving the Consumer, the Community, and the Industry, to Hy-Vee's retired chairman and CEO, Rick Juergens. Juergens accepted the award at the Food Marketing Institute's Midwinter Executive Conference. So, we thought it would be a good opportunity to listen back to my conversation with Rick Juergens from last summer. At that time, he'd just retired as CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee after 43 years with the company. I began our conversation by asking Rick Juergens to tell the story of how Hy-Vee first started.
Well, it's pretty typical of a lot of supermarket chains of the same vintage, a small collection of privately owned stores banded together to form a chain. And since they were all individual owners and entrepreneurs, they decided to have joint ownership and ultimately let the employees join in on that. The original stores were called everything from Hyde stores to Vredenburg to supply stores, and didn't actually become Hy-Vee until 1952 with an employee contest.
And then that's where the name comes from. You mentioned Hyde and Vredenburg. That's where Hy-Vee comes from.
Correct. It's just an abbreviation of the two names. And it came about, ironically, during a day and time when there were a lot of chains with somewhat sing-songy types of names. You may recall Hinky Dinky, and there's still some Piggly Wigglies around,
right,
and that sort of thing.
Right.
And I didn't work for Hy-Vee when I first heard of it and thought it was one of those names. But to me, today, it's one of the most beautiful sounds in the world.
Okay. So before that, give us some context. I know this is before your time. You go back 40-some years in the organization. But let's talk a little bit more about Hy-Vee's origins. Some context for supermarkets in the middle of the 20th century when Hy-Vee got its foothold. A supermarket was still a fairly new idea, wasn't it?
It was. In fact, there were no supermarkets in the 30s when we were founded. They were all little general stores where people stood behind a counter, and even a can of pork and beans was handed to you from a shelf by a clerk. There was very little self-serve at all in those days, and supermarkets really didn't come around in earnest until around the 50s. So I think our first supermarket was in Centerville, Iowa, actually. And by today's standard, that would be somewhat common and old-fashioned. But in those days, it was very much a supermarket.
235 stores in 8 states, Hy-Vee now. Which are the 8 states? Can you name them?
Well, I can. Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, South Dakota.
Okay. Hy-Vee has obviously been tremendously successful. What are the reasons you can point to for that success?
You know, it's a great question, Ben, and I think the most important thing is that we have a culture. We believe there's a certain way that people should be treated, and it came from our founders and has been taught to all of us through the generations of Hy-Vee. not unlike a family would teach principles and values. And we believe that you need to be honest and friendly and respectful, dedicated, and not just to customers, which is somewhat intuitive, but also that to each other and to our vendors and to our communities and to everyone we come in contact with. And I think that was probably the foundation of why our company has succeeded. You couple that with employee ownership and being privately owned. So every decision we make is based on the long-term best interests of our customers, our employees, and our communities. We don't have to deal with the rigors of the marketplace as it relates to what private companies or public companies deal with. We don't have market analysts evaluating the value of our company, for example. And so we're able to make decisions really, we think, in best long-term interest, which ultimately results in companies that last a long time.
Rick Juergens is with us, just retired as the CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee after 43 years of service with the company. If you have a question or a comment, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, 1-866-780-9100, toll-free number, or you can reach us with a tweet at IPR Talk. Tom from Iowa City has this email on a point you just mentioned, Rick Juergens. Hy-Vee promotes itself as employee-owned, but non-management employees do not own stock or sit on the board of directors. Some management employees are granted stock but have to sell it back when they retire or leave the board. There is no union at Hy-Vee. In what way is Hy-Vee employee-owned? Asks Tom from Iowa City.
Sure. Well, that's a great question. And actually, I'm guessing at the number off the top of my head, but some 15,000 employees own stock through the 401k. A certain amount of their 401k contribution from the company is given to them in Hy-Vee stock. The store directors, executive staff, and officers of the company buy stock directly, and then are required, those employees are required to sell that back over a 10-year period after they retire. So I'm in that 10-year buyout right now. So virtually anyone who qualifies to be in the 401k, which is, I believe, 19 years of age, is able to own a small piece of the company.
So it's not just management?
No.
It's any employee. If you're stocking shelves, you own a part of the company?
If you're contributing to the 401k and thus receiving a Hy-Vee match, you are receiving some ownership of the company.
Tell us, what do you see as the biggest milestones in Hy-Vee's, I guess it's an 80-year-plus evolution? How has Hy-Vee changed?
Well, obviously we've had a multitude of changes in terms of format. You know, our stores are much, much larger. For example, when I first came to the company in 1969, I went to work in 71 at Muscatine in a brand new store that was 18,000 square foot, was a fairly large store for our company at that point. Today, our stores will be 80 to 100,000 square foot. So there are dramatic changes. The original store that I worked in had four departments. Today, there'll be 25 or more departments in the store. So dramatic changes there. Of much more significance, I think, is that our company has not changed in our ownership structure, in our belief system, our value structure, and in our zeal to make a difference in the world. And those things have remained constant and really been a big factor in our evolution.
1-866-780-9100 to talk with Rick Juergens, former CEO, retired CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee. Let's go to Doug, who's joining us from Davenport. Hi, Doug.
Hey, how are you guys?
We're doing great. Do you have a question
Good.
Or a comment?
Just a comment. I was just kind of wondering, with the advent of technology and the mobile apps, do you think we're going to be heading in a direction where you could possibly, you know, order your items online, have a personal shopper actually do the shopping for you, to where all you have to do is pull up and pick up your items and pay? I'll take my answer off the air.
Great question, Doug. The Hy-Vee and the digital age. What has happened? What will happen?
Well, thanks for that question, Doug. And actually, I'm embarrassed to say that we already do that in many of our stores, and possibly even in a store near you. We maybe haven't done as good a job in publicizing it, and But we do have stores who actually will take an order either online or over the phone, fill the order, and even deliver it in some cases if that's appropriate. We've had some people that were shut in for a variety of reasons and couldn't get out, and so we're happy to accommodate them to the best of our ability. I think you'll see that grow over time as more and more people become acclimated to shopping online, and that's clearly a growth area. We just launched a new app for mobile apps for people with iPhones and Androids that they can actually, while they're in the store, locate an item by punching in toothpicks, and it will take them right to the item in the store. We're very excited about that, and that's part of the continuum. We just continue to try to respond to the needs and wants of our consumers, and as consumers demand and expect more from technology, we're going to try to be there to deliver it for them.
When you look back over the decades, you have four-plus decades to look after over, how would you compare the way a consumer for food shops for food today with how they shopped a generation or two ago? How have we as food consumers, shoppers, change the way we go down those aisles? Well, we just mentioned the digital thing where you don't even have to go down the aisle. I guess you go down a virtual aisle at home, right?
Correct. And there have been other changes. One of the more fascinating things, in the early stores, there was a very clear traffic pattern for a consumer. They would come in the stores, they would go down the odd aisles and up the even aisles. And frankly, the preponderance of customers did that. They would go up and down each aisle getting the various things they needed, sometimes skipping the aisle, but they would still go through the exercise. Today, people come in from two separate entrances, and they go every direction possible depending on their needs. And sometimes they have a destination shop where they're going to the pharmacy or to the floral department or simply going to one of the food service departments to take food home with them. And so their traffic pattern in the store is dramatically different and virtually impossible to predict. Mm-hmm.
How does that change your design, your layout of what products, what areas you put where?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and it creates a constant challenge. But what we try to do, what we've come to is, we believe we should try to set the store to suit the consumer. And there's a temptation in any retail chain to try to set it to sell them what we want them to buy, and we just don't find that to be as successful. So what we try to do is anticipate their needs. So, for example, there's a number of ways you could set a section within the store, like peanut butter and jelly. And so we try to make it so if they're looking at the peanut butter section, they can see everything in that section easily and do their price comparisons and their quality comparisons and make those decisions easily and quickly. Speed is a priority to our consumers today, and they're time crunched, and so we have to do that. Now, I'll take that same category and be a little bit contradictory, but for the same reason. If you're looking for organic peanut butter, for the most part, you will find that in our health market, because we find the organic consumer likes the convenience of all of the organics being compressed into one area. So they don't need to travel the entire store to find just organic products. And the typical organic customer today doesn't buy organic only, but they have certain items where they will only buy organic.
Organics are here to stay.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Fastest growing category in our stores for the last 10 or 12 years.
Rick Juergens, former CEO, retired CEO, and chairman of Hy-Vee after 43 years with the company. A Twitter question from one of our listeners, Rob. Rob writes, I notice that Hy-Vee's prices are consistently higher than other chains like Fairway. What do you attribute that to?
Well, you know, I think if you take an overall market basket at Hy-Vee, you will find us to be very competitive. We have a number of things that we do to create our value structure for our customers. There's everyday pricing, and we work hard to be as aggressive as we can. We also have temporary price declines in which either store by store or through value we create with vendors, we can lower the price. And then we do a great deal of advertising. And those ad prices when shop can drive our prices well below the market. And so we think we obviously give a value proposition, or we wouldn't be able to succeed as well as we have over the last several years, which has been the worst economic situation I've seen in my 43 years in the business. And yet our company was able to grow and add stores and jobs. And we think we provide a great value to our consumers.
There's a lot of talk about, in politics at least, about regulations being a problem in the commercial sector, about it limiting job growth or stymieing job growth. Are there any regulations, I wonder, that you think are especially burdensome and have little value in retailing of food?
You know, it's not so much the regulations, it's the administration of them that adds cost to food. And so what we've tried to do at Hy-Vee, I had the privilege of serving as the chairman of the Food Marketing Institute, which is the largest trade organization in the world in the food business. And we've worked very hard in the FMI to try to work out ahead of key issues that are going to affect consumers, and either work with the government or even ahead of the government when appropriate, to try and provide what's needed without the regulation. So, for example, we just developed over the last few years a front-of-pack labeling concept, which we think will help consumers make better choices on the products they purchase, especially if they're interested in the nutritional value of them. And so companies around America, including Hy-Vee, we were the first retailer to begin that implementation on our private label products, are implementing that ahead of the government. We didn't wait for government regulation to develop it. And as a result, we can do it, we think, more cost-effectively and efficiently, and really provide consumers what they want at the end of the day. I will say, to be honest with you, regulations can be frustrating, even irritating, and sometimes feel punitive. But at the end of the day, we all have to deal with them. And so our attitude at Hy-Vee has always been to try to live to the letter of the law and beyond. I can tell you that, for example, with food safety inspections, we've developed a process that is much more rigorous than what the inspectors who come into our stores have. And that way, we think we're living up to our responsibility of doing everything we can to provide safe food to consumers.
Is there one, if you had to choose, one regulatory change you could make, what would most benefit Hy-Vee that you would choose?
I'm not sure I could answer that question. I'm not wild about a number of them, but none of them are.
For instance?
Well, like cool. The country of origin labeling, great idea. It lets consumers know where products come from. But without getting into all the nitty-gritty, which we don't have time for, the details and the cost of technology to track what the government expects us to track to be able to respond to questions that they have is just frankly raising the price of food. There's an example where I think the legislation is fine. The bureaucracy behind it is excessive and creating more cost than is necessary. But frankly, our industry, if we'd address that appropriately ourselves, we wouldn't have had to deal with the government issue. And that's why we're trying to be more proactive in anticipating consumers' needs and wants.
Rick Juergens, CEO and chairman of Hy-Vee, retired after 43 years. A final 5 minutes. Here's a nice email from Sarah in Davenport listening to our program. She writes, "I recently moved back to the Quad Cities. While away, I lived in Georgia and New York. One of the things my husband and I missed most was Hy-Vee. You don't realize how much the culture of their stores affect your grocery shopping until you're in a Kroger and the employees huff at you when you ask them a question or bring a full cart to their checkout." Okay, so much for Southern hospitality. I'll take Midwest culture any day of the week. There you go. You can use that for some promotion.
Sarah, that's very kind of you. And let me just welcome you back to Iowa. This state's going to be a lot better off with someone as nice and kind-hearted as you are. I appreciate it a lot.
You know, everyone around the office today, because we had some Hy-Vee, various versions of the Hy-Vee jingle out, have been whistling or humming it. Do you have a whistling, humming, or singing version of the the Hy-Vee melody.
Is there something you don't like about your consumers or your customers and listeners, Ben?
you're telling me you don't do it very well, huh?
No, well, no, I've loved the jingle forever, and obviously it's such a key part of our company. In fact, you'll see it in some upcoming commercials that they're working on. It's going to be emphasized a little bit more. We feel like we've been a little bit negligent in letting people hear it. It's almost a part of Iowa history, as most of us know it, and so we want to keep it alive, and hopefully you'll hear it sung by a lot better singers than I am.
Okay, a couple quick things before we have to go, Rick Juergens. In fiscal year 2011, Hy-Vee total sales of $7.3 billion ranks among the top 25 supermarket chains in the U.S. Where to from here? Any room for expansion into other states, more stores?
Certainly, although our long-term plans at this point primarily involve filling in voids. For example, we only have one store in Wisconsin today. Well, there are a lot of towns between here and Madison where our first store went that we can add Hy-Vees. Plus, we'll probably have at least two more stores in Madison. We'll continue to expand into Illinois, Missouri, and other states. Minnesota, before we venture out into others. But, you know, it's always a possibility. If the right opportunity confronted us, we might venture into another state. But the advantage to us is leveraging our existing facilities and staffing by sort of growing city to city rather than leapfrogging out to Florida or Georgia or that sort of thing.
Okay, we have just about a minute left. Rick Juergens, you've been with Hy-Vee for 43 years. You're now retiring. What are your plans for retirement?
Well, you don't have time for that, but I've already been this week to a guitar lesson and art lesson. I've been at rowed in an 8-man sweep rowing boat, played golf, I've boated, kayaked, and played with my grandchildren. I'm going to the baseball game tonight. It's going to be a little wild and woolly, but I'm going to have a lot of fun. And most importantly, I'm staying involved with the Healthiest State Initiative. I promised the governor I'd help make Iowa the healthiest state in America, and I'm going to live up to that promise, and we're going to make that happen.
So you're taking guitar lessons. What type of music do you like to play?
Well, mostly...
Or want to play. Perhaps you're really at the early stages, and you can't pick a genre quite yet until you get through the basics.
No, I've actually written two songs as well. One was a blues tune, and the other was a song for my wife, Carol, that I played at our... I didn't play it myself. I had my guitar instructor sing it at my retirement dinner. And so kind of in the rock and blues sort of genres, I guess, I'm most comfortable.
With such a successful career, what does Rick Juergens have to sing the blues about or write a blues song about?
Yeah, it was just for the fun of doing it. It was, and it wasn't about me. It was about a guy I made up who lost his girlfriend, and the name of the song is Hot Water. It's a lot of fun.
Did he meet her in a supermarket aisle by chance?
Well, probably not in a Hy-Vee aisle, or he wouldn't have lost her, because in this song he loses her.
A conversation I had last June with Hy-Vee's retired chairman and CEO, Rick Juergens. This week he was honored by the Food Marketing Institute. Well, here's some Hy-Vee music you probably haven't heard.
Shopping Hy-Vee style. Hy-Vee style. Welcome to our store.
Coming up, Grant and Denise Staskel just sold their house in North Liberty. They bought a boat and plan to spend the next 6 months sailing the Pacific Ocean. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
The tasty Marion Hy-Vee, our produce so fresh and clean. Marion Hy-Vee, our catering's the best you've seen.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Many of us dream of breaking away from our day-to-day lives, of having the courage and the means to do something completely different. Most of us never make it happen and never manage to take that leap. Well, my next guests are taking that leap into a new life, and joining me now in our studio in Iowa City, a young couple who until very recently were residents of North Liberty, owned a house there. Grant and Denise Staskel are with us in the studio. You sold your house just a little while ago. What did you sell it for?
We traded our house for a sailboat. And we currently live in California on our sailboat. And our plans are to outfit that boat and cross the Pacific Ocean.
Wow. Okay, in Ventura. Mm-hmm. Denise, what's in the near future?
We have two sort of plans. One plan is to potentially take our boat offshore and cross the Pacific to the French Polynesia. But if that doesn't quite work out, then our second plan is to just cruise up and down the coast of California, all the way down to Mexico, the Baja, and then back up to maybe San Francisco or maybe even farther than that. So,
and this journey gets underway in January 2013?
Not quite January, but in about 6 months. There's a specific time period that is safe on the ocean. There are, I guess you'd say, seasons as well as on land, and there's a specific type of season that you don't want to be crossing the Atlantic.
Namely typhoon season,
which right you want to avoid that.
Pacific equivalent of hurricane is the typhoon, and half of the year you do not want to be out there because of weather.
How long have you been living up to now in North Liberty? How many years?
Three years. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So how did this idea get hatched? Who hatched this idea first?
A few years ago, my wife, Denise, asked me to get a hobby. And out of that came sailing. And we slowly figured out that there's actually a sailing club very close by here in Iowa City that has been around for quite a few years, a wonderful club. From that, we continued growing in our passion for sailing.
Yeah, because originally we thought in order to learn how to sail, we thought we'd have to go to Chicago or, Lake Michigan or somewhere with bigger water and boats.
Right.
But, on a whim, we were at C2C Water Sports in Cedar Rapids, and they said, oh, have you heard of the University of Iowa Sailing Club? And we're like, no. And so we searched for it, and we found it, and that's kind of how we got started with sailing. And little did I know when I told my husband to find a hobby that he would find sailing and it would lead to this. But,
right.
It's been really enjoyable.
And you lived in North Liberty. North Liberty, very close, right? Close to Lake McBride, where the University of Iowa Sailing Club has its home.
Correct. Yes.
Full disclosure, I am also a member of the University of Iowa Sailing Club, and Denise and Grant, this is how we met each other.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So we're all sailors here, but you're taking it to quite a different level. So the idea to go to sell the house, get a boat, how big is this boat?
It is a 37-foot sailboat. Like you might imagine the size of a dorm room as the amount of space that we have.
Not quite shaped.
Inside the boat.
Not quite shaped like a dorm
no,
room.
No, but shaped like a dorm room, but if you were to potentially look at the square footage of it, it might be very similar to a dorm room. It's just hard to kind of imagine the square footage of a canoe-shaped object when you know that the middle of the canoe is at least 10 feet wide. Mm-hmm. And you can, it's, what is it, how many feet tall?
I can stand up in it, so it's actually 6 feet 4 inches is the headroom.
So you've got a cozy little a place to sleep, of a living room area, and a galley.
Galley, correct. And yep. There's a bathroom, and then there's they call it the V-berth, but it's like a bedroom type. Mm-hmm. But it can actually sleep up to 6 people if you really want to get cozy. Yeah.
Okay, so I can come out and visit, huh?
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, how did you come across this boat?
We both like to read, and I spent a lot of time reading about sailing and dreaming about sailing in between sailing here at Lake McBride in Iowa. And from all of the boats I looked at, I was most interested in a company by the name of Pacific Seacraft, and that's actually the brand of boat that we have. I was interested in them because the designer saw to it that safety and seaworthiness would be the top two priorities.
And from my perspective, too, like normally it wouldn't be something that I would think of doing. Like, I wouldn't think of just going out and buying a boat and living on a boat. But
So this was Grant's idea.
This is mostly Grant's idea, yes.
Did you need any convincing?
Oh, of course I needed convincing. It took a long time. I mean, it took months and months. First, I was convinced that, I would enjoy having my own boat. And then after that, the convincing was, would I be willing to live on it? Okay, well, yes, I would be willing. It took some time. There was like different baby steps that I had to take to get to this point. Obviously, I just didn't leap on board and and want to go like right away. But I truly have been enjoying it up to this point.
I understand that the way the previous owner and the way which you came across this boat had something of a meant-to-be story.
There were interesting coincidences, at the very least, if not perhaps even divine intervention, in how we met the previous owners. And they actually specifically, towards the end of the purchasing process, came out and told us that they wanted us to have this boat because they had felt that the dream that we had today was their dream 20 years ago. And unfortunately, for health reasons, they had to sell their boat. And so it was somewhat of a bittersweet process to go through.
So you were actually carrying the dreams of another older couple or
yes.
older people
yes,
with you.
We
that's,
are.
That's interesting.
Yes.
Now, this boat was previously in the Great Lakes, and you have it now
right.
in the Pacific in California.
Right. Its whole life, it's a 20-year-old boat, but in very good condition, and its whole life it lived in Lake Michigan until we, a few weeks ago, shipped it over land to the Pacific Ocean in Ventura, California.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the why of this, because we've got the what. You're going to take this boat. You've got this boat. It's in docked in California right now.
Right.
In a marina there.
Yep.
And soon you're going to be setting out sailing along the coast of California, or perhaps to the French Polynesian Islands, as you said there, Denise. Why? Why now?
Yes, that's a question we get often is why,
yeah,
and why now? Mostly why. For me, what is very appealing and unique about this journey is the independence and the adventure of discovery of setting out on your own and doing something in a self-sufficient kind of way that many people don't do, that could lead to meeting new and unique people and seeing new and unique places.
Mm-hmm. And my response to why is why not? Because, you know, I just think that right now is the right time for us. You know, we're in between. We just got married about 3 years ago. We're in between having, you know, starting a family. And so this is just kind of a great adventure to kind of embark on at this point in our lives, because we have our health. We have, you know, so much drive and, you know, we work together really well. We want to meet new people. I love to travel. So, and, you know, traveling has so many different forms to it. You know,
right.
you can fly in a plane, you can drive in a car, you could go walking somewhere or biking. But sailing to me is just so relaxing. And learning how to sail to me was just this huge stress reliever, like from the day-to-day, you know, job and anything.
How does it do that, actually?
How does it do that? That's a good question. Well, because sailing has so many components to it, it's kind of like playing golf in a sense where, you know, you don't just get up to the ball and swing, because that usually leads to disaster. Usually the ball will go either way. And sailing is the same thing. Like when you're on a boat, you have to think about which way the wind is coming and how on a dinghy there's no weighted bottom. So you are the weight and you have to be constantly thinking about what's going to happen next. And so because you're thinking of all these things, you don't have time to think about what happened at work today that, you know, really drove me bonkers and that kind of thing. You're just lost. You're like stuck in the moment.
You're describing is a sort of meditation, isn't it?
Yeah, it's.
There are enough things to keep you busy in the process of sailing that the rest of the world for a moment melts away.
If you've just joined us, my guests this half hour are Denise and Grant Staskel. They just sold their house in North Liberty after being residents there for 3 years. They sold their house to buy a boat, a 37-foot, what was the maker?
Pacific Seacraft.
Pacific Seacraft. And they'll be spending the next year, a good part of the next year, we can be assured, sailing in the Pacific. Not sure quite where there will be. I guess you just let it unfold when that happens.
It is a somewhat open-ended plan.
As a sailor, you kind of have to be open to change. And so, because things can change in a moment's notice. So, you know, yeah, we have our main plan, but, you know, we're always got kind of a backup, you know.
In our mind, it's not a total disaster if that exact day or that exact moment doesn't happen exactly how we thought it would.
How are you making this happen financially?
I thought that it may be possible to get a leave of absence from my job, and I'm still not sure how that's going to work. Right now, the way it looks is we will be leaving our jobs temporarily to go do this, and for the simple fact that out in the open water, you know, we don't have connections and smartphones and things that we can reliably use to communicate and get day-to-day work done.
But in marinas and harbors, when you're docked, you regularly have Wi-Fi now.
Absolutely.
Correct. Okay. And so we're currently working now. We're currently working all the way up until the point where we have to make a decision to either leave our jobs or stay with it, depending on our plan. I mean, if we were to cruise up and down the coast of California, potentially we could keep our jobs. It would just be, you know, a week at a time, or not even a week, maybe
a few
days.
You can work through the internet or distance working.
Oftentimes cruisers find, even in the most distant ports that have no technology, that they can get a job if they're willing to work and paint the side of a hull, do a little electronics work. There's opportunities for temporary work all over.
Denise, what do you imagine you will enjoy most about this journey?
I think it'll be meeting people and just learning about different cultures and stuff like that. That's something that I've always enjoyed doing, seeing different cultures and learning about them and what their day-to-day life is. And so it's just interesting to see how they make it work with using what they have, you know.
And Grant, you?
Same answer. I would add to that I love travel and I love meeting people as much as Denise does. But for me, the sailing experience itself is icing on the cake. So to be able to put both of those together is a really fantastic thing for me.
You've obviously done a lot of research about this. You have your sailing skills learned in Iowa.
Absolutely.
Perhaps the people in California may make a bit of fun of. Maybe not. I don't know.
Well,
although the Great Lakes have as much dangerous weather as the coasts oftentimes. And so, you know, Midwest sailors can hold their own. There's
And I would add to, there's something to be said for learning to sail in a dinghy. A dinghy is a smaller type of sailboat that would fit maybe one or two people. And it doesn't have a weighted bottom, so there's no keel. And basically what that means is if the wind is in your sails and your boat is heeling over or pushed over to the side at an angle, if you do not counterbalance that weight from the wind, you are going to fall into the water, basically. The boat
As capsize.
Yeah, maybe the boat will capsize.
You might go swimming.
You'll probably capsize. But what I'm trying to say with this analogy is that, learning to sail in a dinghy is the best way to learn how to sail, because if you make a mistake, you're instantly in the water. So you know you've done something wrong. And so then you work to fix that the next time around. Mm-hmm. And I will also add that we went to the Southern Caribbean and chartered a boat for 7 days. And so we've done charters before. We've chartered in the Southern Caribbean. Last June, we've chartered in St. Thomas and
Lake Superior.
Lake Superior was another charter that we did. Mm-hmm. So we've done charters before on bigger boats for longer periods of time. And so that's kind of where I've come to the conclusion that I'm able to move aboard a boat, and I do enjoy, you know, living aboard for even 10 days at a time. So why not full time?
What are the biggest differences though between sailing a lake in the Midwest and the ocean? Surely there is quite a difference. The Pacific, you said earlier, you wanted to avoid typhoons.
Absolutely.
You're going to have, nevertheless, some rough weather at times.
Yes, we will. And we expect that. You expect every once in a while to have
a squall, a storm,
conditions that are not always fun, but
what you talked about, what you're most looking forward to, what are you most worried about?
You know, if you would have asked me like a year ago what I was worried about, I would have said storms, waves, like all kinds of stuff. But that's all kind of, I've moved on from that. Like, I'm not really.
How did you move on from that?
I've talked to people. I've learned about it. I've met with people that have sailed, and, you know, they've kind of like calmed my fears about that type of stuff.
And the realization that that type of weather is very
rare.
Unusual.
Yeah. I mean, most people, anyone, you know, would think going offshore means big waves and crazy weather and no land. I mean, yes, there's not going to be land in sight for so many days. And how do you deal with that? And are you prepared to deal with that? But the truth is that sometimes the out in the middle of the ocean, it can be as calm as Lake McBride because there's no wind or that kind of thing. So it just depends on where you're.
A big worry of mine is, and I'm sure this is true for many sailors, is a man overboard situation where someone actually falls out of the boat.
Right, and there are only two of you on the boat. So
there will only be two of us.
There better be at least one staying on.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And so,
so how we deal with it,
thinking goes into preventing that type of a scenario. Mm-hmm.
Are both of you from Iowa?
Yeah.
Yes.
Natives of Iowa?
Yep. Yes.
So you've got family around here in the Cedar Rapids, North
and
Liberty
Iowa,
era?
In Dubuque area.
Okay. Cedar Rapids and Dubuque are families.
Mm-hmm. What do they think of this idea?
What
was their first reaction?
Well, as any parents would have, their first reaction is going to be that of concern and just wondering, you know, a lot about it. And I think
my mom at one point said, "Are you sure you want to do this?"
what was your answer?
Yes, we do want to do this.
But I think they've been supportive as they can be, you know. And I think the struggle for them is that, you know, they want to impart some kind of wisdom, but at the same time, they're not sure, you know, they don't understand sailing to that point. So they're not sure what type of wisdom to impart. So they will try as best they can to, you know, make sure that you're prepared to do something like this.
And they're going to be hearing from you how often?
We plan on having either a satellite phone for emergencies or some means of communication. It will not be regular updates like you would think of picking up a cell phone and calling every hour or every day. At the end of the day, it will most likely be a weekly or biweekly communication.
What do you think you'll do with all the time you have on board? You said there are calm times too, so you can set course.
We can set course,
and you have relatively stable, calmer winds, stable. Well, what do you want to do on board?
A lot of times, there are many systems that in the normal movement of the boat offshore that can break and get bumped or vibrated or moved and stop working. And so a lot of times what you do is you make a list of the things that you want to maintain and proactively check them to make sure they are still working. Mm-hmm. So we'll be plenty busy with maintenance, not exactly a pleasure cruise in the sense that you can sort of sit down and relax for 20 days
that,
as you cross.
And then the other thing that's essential to do is our daily log updates, which you know, you set a specific time and you then go back each day at that time and you track how far you've come, what the wind conditions were, what the wave and weather, you know, wave heights and weather conditions were, so that you kind of keep track of your progress as you're going along. And the other thing is, too, when you're offshore, the boat does not stop moving, so there's always a watch schedule, which means that one of us has to be on deck for a period of time watching so that we don't potentially run into someone or something out in the ocean. Not that that's
24/7 for days, maybe even weeks. Mm-hmm. Both of you will not be able to sleep at the same time.
There will be periods throughout any 24-hour day that we will not be able to be asleep at the same time. But there will also be a good part of that day where we will be awake at the same time. So it is not as if we'll be passing each other like ships in the night and we'll never see each other.
We'll be seeing each
You'll
other.
One will come up from the sleeping cabin and wave to the other, say, "Hey, honey, change a shift.
See you in 24 hours.
Plus then you have to make meal. I mean, there's lots of stuff to do throughout the day. But, I mean, you know, it's not going to be like you have the internet to hop on and, like, keep you busy for a while or Facebook to keep you busy for a while. I mean, we'll have to do blog updates, but, you know,
Because of the maintenance and things that we will be doing day to day, it's going to be important for us to find moments where we can enjoy and break up the time as we go past.
Yeah, and a lot of things, too. Like, you can bring books on tape to listen to and, like, that kind of thing.
Lots of options.
There's lots of options of stuff to
do. We haven't talked about food. Will you be eating only the food that you bring on board, or will you be catching some of your food?
We hope to catch some of our food. We haven't done a lot. I don't think we've done any offshore fishing yet, but that is on our list of things to learn to do.
Yeah.
To be able to throw a line out while we're sailing and hopefully catch dolphin tuna or something.
Something.
Delicious.
Well, we do certainly hope you'll check back. In the meantime, I want to wish you fair weather and great sailing and a great adventure, a great journey, Denise and Grant Staskel of North Liberty, on your adventure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
In the moonlight and you, wouldn't that be heaven, a heaven just for two?
And we'll put a photo of Denise and Grant Staskel on our website so you can see their eager faces full of adventure. Also, so you can follow their journey, a link to their blog, which is at vagabondingundersail.org. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.